This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC. Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
Pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
Welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Caroline.
And Caroline, I feel like we're going to be so redundant even saying this because our listeners are about to hear our intro all over again.
Well, but it's great that you're going to hear it again because it's actually interactive and kind of special.
It's very special. So today you're going to hear our live Stuff Mom Never Told You show from South by Southwest. And to any of you who are listening to this right now who were there at Speakeasy in downtown Austin, thank you so much for coming. It was a ton of fun.
It was a ton of fun. And it's always so great to meet you guys. And to remember that there are amazing people out there, men and women alike, who listen to us, that it's not just us in this padded cell of a recording studio. And I was so glad that so many people got to hear all of the amazing things that our guest, Nicole Cabrera, had to say.
And since Nicole's going to introduce herself in the live show in which we talk about sexism and science communication with a focus on astronomy for a reason that will make itself very known very soon. Caroline, should we just dive right in?
Let's dive right in.
All right, folks. So here you go. Live from South by Southwest, it's Stuff Mom Never Told You.
Since this is being recorded, we're really just going to pretend that we're all in the Stuff Mom Never Told You studio together, yeah. Although be glad that we aren't because it's a tiny room.
It would be so sweaty.
It would be very uncomfortable. But this is our Stuff Mom Never Told You studio today, and we're going to start our show the same way we start all of our podcasts. We're going to say our names, and then when I point to you, say, and I'm, and then say your name. And it'll sound, you know, just like...
It'll be a mess.
A hot mess.
We're going to...
You'll love it.
It's going to add to the effect.
All right. You ready?
I'm holding this like it's a steering wheel. Let's do it.
Okay, cool. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Caroline.
And I'm Nicole.
I caught all of those names.
And I'll remember every one of them.
That's so good. Yeah. So today we're talking about sexism and science communication. And we're going to let Nicole talk a little bit about why it's so relevant to talking about it here at South by Southwest Interactive, because technology is a huge part of these conversations that are going on. So first of all, Nicole, would you just introduce yourself to our wonderful audience?
Sure. My name is Nicole Cabrera Salazar, and I am a PhD student at Georgia State University. I study astronomy, and if everything goes well, I'll be graduating with my PhD at the end of this year. So I will be Dr. Cabrera Salazar.
Thank you. Yep. And so tell us why, beyond just hanging out with us, you're here at South By.
This is actually the reason.
Oh.
Okay. I flew all this way. Well, I have a panel that's it's not just my panel, actually, but Jen Goldbeck, who's a TED Fellow, and my friend Summer Ash. We're doing a panel tomorrow at, I think, 5 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken, on it's called hashtag distractingly sexy, and it has to do with how to fight science sexism on social media. And we're going to talk about all the different Twitter campaigns that have started to fight all of the science sexism that y'all have been hearing about recently.
Yeah, so we're going to kind of give a little intro to some of that stuff that you're going to be talking about even more in depth tomorrow. But first, we want to tell our meet cute story with Nicole, because it involves a wonderful email to momstuff@howstuffworks.com.
Where you can also email us cute things.
Yes.
Okay, so we had done a two-part episode on women in astronomy.
We got really into it. It was originally going to be one episode, but then we had to make it two.
It can't be contained.
Yeah.
Because it's that much sexism. So we got this email from a fabulous lady named Nicole. And she said, you mentioned in your podcast that you were wondering if there would be any lady Neil deGrasse Tysons anytime soon. It just so happens that I'm getting my PhD in astronomy, graduating next year, and I'll be going into astronomy education and public outreach. Sorry if this is embarrassing. The same sort of thing Neil deGrasse Tyson does, just on a smaller scale. I'm not sure if I'll ever achieve this kind of fame, but I'm super passionate about making astronomy accessible to everyone, and I want to focus my career on encouraging women and minorities to pursue STEM careers.
That's right.
So how could we not reach out to Nicole? Also, because she was in Atlanta, and be like, hey, let's be friends. Yeah. And let's talk in Austin. And Nicole has a fantastic TED Talk that you should absolutely watch after this. And I, because I'm creepy, was watching it this morning while I was doing my hair. I'm a fan.
Yeah.
Not too stalky.
No.
And one thing that jumped out to me, Nicole, was how you were talking about being a feminist since you were 11, which I was like, dang, impressive. But it wasn't until you really started pursuing STEM education, higher education, that it awakened more of your intersectional awareness and the activism that you're focused on now. So could you just kind of take us through your journey with that?
Sure. So I did talk about this a little bit in my talk, and it's that there's a lot of machismo. I grew up in Miami, so a lot of Hispanic people. I grew up in a place, somebody from Miami is here. I was not the minority, right? My high school, I think, I might have known maybe two white people growing up, and that was just normal for me. And it was actually not until I came to Atlanta. I went to a community college first, Miami-Dade College, which was fantastic. And then I transferred to Georgia Tech, which was my high school physics teacher's alma mater, and I wanted to go there because he went there. And then when I moved to Atlanta, I very quickly realized that I was a minority there. And that was really shocking for me. It was a huge culture shock. So I had been a feminist since I was young because, you know, I had recognized all of the shit that women have to go through, in my culture. But as far as, you know, my race being any part of that, I just wasn't aware until I had to, you know, especially at Georgia Tech, where there are just very few women and very few minorities, compared to the demographic of Atlanta, compared to the demographic of the United States. So that was just a huge, shock for me.
Yeah. Well, tell us about what led you to astronomy in the first place?
Well, so in high school, I had this really encouraging physics teacher who was amazing, and he saw my potential, and he nurtured that. And so I decided I wanted to be in physics, so I went to Georgia Tech, and I studied physics. And while I was there, my first semester there, I had an astronomy class, and it was awesome, and I thought, this is amazing. So I started doing research with my astronomy professor. And he said, you know, you should apply for summer internships. The National Science Foundation, they fund these internships over the summer, and you go and they pay you. And so I applied to 10 different ones that year, and I got into just one, and it was in Hawaii. So, of course, I wasn't going to turn that down, and I got to live in Hawaii for 3 months. I got to go up to the telescopes and use the telescopes. I got to do full-time astronomy research. And I was like, yeah, I could do this for life. So that's how I decided to go into astronomy. And then, of course, I applied to grad school, and here I am.
Well, so, but what is the intersection, though? I mean, we are talking about intersectionality, but what is the intersection of you studying astronomy and getting into the sciences and realizing, oh, wait, I actually want to go over to the advocacy activist arena?
Right. So I had, as soon as I came to Atlanta and I started my bachelor's in physics, I realized that not only was I the only woman in all of my physics classes, but I was also the only minority. So it was all white dudes and me. And that can be really intimidating, and I was just super aware of that. And so I wanted to connect with other women, and I always had been passionate about science education and just like telling people about astronomy because it's so cool. And I just focused a lot of that energy trying to reach people like me. So because I had a hard time going through that, the year that I graduated, I was the only woman graduating with a physics degree, and I'm pretty sure the only minority as well, just in from Georgia Tech. And so that had a huge effect on me. And then grad school, I came in wanting to be a researcher. I was there for, I think, 4 years. And after that, there was just a lot of hardship that you have to go through, a lot of intimidating places, and just you have a different experience, I feel like, than when you're a white dude who has tons of other white dudes around him validating his experience. And I had a lot of just difficulties in my department or in my experience as a grad student that I always thought were like because I was a lady. But then I realized that some of the white women around me were not experiencing the same things, right? And so I was like, wow, like maybe race has something to do with it too. And so that was really shocking for me. And also just knowing that the number of sacrifices I would have to make in my life in order to make it as a professor, right? Like you have to give so much up and you have to, you know, travel the world doing temporary research positions and then publishing lots of papers. And that means working around the clock and maybe putting off having a family and putting off, you know, having a good work-life balance. And I didn't want that. As a woman, you have to be much, much more competitive than your male counterparts in order to make it as far. And I just thought, you know, it's not worth it for me. I might get to the end of that and be in my late 30s, early 40s, and there might not be a job for me, guaranteed. So, and then I'm going to have to change careers at that point. I'd rather do something that I'm also passionate about and that I can really dedicate my life to and sort of dictate the terms of.
So in the process of all this, I'm curious if you sort of found your community, people who had experienced similar things and probably felt similarly isolated at all.
Yeah, so it wasn't until last year, not even a year ago, there was this huge, hugely different conference that was started called Inclusive Astronomy. And it was the very first conference of its kind, and it had to do with, you know, we're going to talk about these issues, all the isms in astronomy, mm-hmm. ableism, sexism, racism, and how it affects our young scientists, and what are we going to do about it, too? So it was this, like, 3 or 4 day conference. I took maybe 7 grad students with me. It was in Nashville. And over those 3 days, we learned about, you know, systemic racism. We learned about how sexism affects the numbers. And we also put together recommendations for the community, the astronomy community, in terms of universities, departments, the National Science Foundation, you know, NASA. What can we recommend to them to make it better for people like me and for other people at other intersections? And so that, going to that conference, that was the first time I had met other Latina astronomers. Very first time. And I'm like, you know, very far along in my graduate career. And so that was a huge shock to me. And it just made me realize, like, wow, I haven't had this community this whole time. It has been very isolating, and I need to be able to have that so that I can succeed.
And it seems like, to that point, in the context of being here at South By, that social media and tech have facilitated some of that community building.
Absolutely.
As well.
Yes, yes, because so a lot of these conversations you can't have in real life because most of your colleagues they don't get it, right? If they're not experiencing those things, you know, a lot of guys have told me, like, wow, I can't believe all this sexual harassment in astronomy is happening. Like, they just had no idea, and it's happening right under your nose, right? But it's because when you don't have to experience some identity, then you're completely blind to it. And so I have found online several communities that I can connect with, other like-minded people who are fighting for those same rights in astronomy and in science in general. And those are the people that I've really been able to connect with so that I don't feel so isolated and alone. Yeah.
Well, and it seems, too, that speaking of astronomy, that's really been the hotbed for a lot of this. There's been so much activism specifically within astronomy. And as a layperson, it surprised me. I mean, I had no idea, but also that tells you a lot about how much I know about the day-to-day workings of astronomers. But curious to know, why astronomy?
So I really think, what we have to realize, and this is something that we're going to talk about more tomorrow, is that science is not above culture, right? A science is actually deeply entrenched in the culture that we all live in. And that means that there's going to be, if there's going to be sexism in society, if there's going to be sexual harassment in society, it's going to happen in science as well. The problem is that we associate science as being this objective, noble field where nothing bad can happen because scientists are, you know, so objective and so smart and everything. And of course they're going to be above that, but they're not. And also another problem is that, you know, in academia in general, not just in science, but just in academia, you have professors who are, you know, they're bringing in millions of dollars in grants and they have tenure. So it's really hard to get them fired, and they're more powerful, and you have these younger grad students or undergrad students sometimes that have no power, and they are not as important to the universities as these professors are. And so we have a community that's actually willing to talk about these issues. So starting, I think, with that Inclusive Astronomy Conference, and even much before, there are members of the astronomy community who have been fighting this all along. And when that story broke out, our community rallied together on social media so that Jeff Marcy would get fired, because, you know, in the midst of all this, you know, it came out that the Title IX investigation that he went through, they found him in violation. He had harassed several students, undergraduate students, and more than we even know about. And the University of California, Berkeley said, well, the next time you do something like this, you might get fired. And our community was outraged. And so the people in this community really fought through social media, a lot of the younger people, and putting pressure on journalists and putting pressure on departments and agencies. And that's why you're hearing about it. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's not happening in other places. It's mm-hmm. that we're speaking out. And that's actually a good sign, because it means that we're having these open discussions. And so hopefully other fields will also follow that example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask more about Jeff Marcy. So he's what, an exoplanet researcher? Is that what? Okay. And when news broke that he had been harassing women, and this had been going on for a decade, which he described as just misunderstandings, you know, just plain and simple, it was really greeted as like an open secret. Like, people had known about what was going on with Marcy and these women that he was harassing for years. So we were wondering, how is that kind of willful blindness even possible?
So it's possible because, again, because of the culture we live in and the culture of silence that surrounds these, you know, survivors of sexual assault and mm-hmm. sexual harassment. So you have, first of all, there's a power imbalance. This thing is actually quite planned out. There's something that in the Women in Astronomy blog was called the Harasser's Playbook. So, I mean, it's kind of like grooming victims, and mm-hmm. it's always this power, huge power imbalance where the person who's doing the harassing has a hold on your career somehow. And they are afraid to report, because if they report, then it gets dragged, you know, through the media or, you know, in the community, even in these small communities, you need recommendation letters from your advisors. If this guy is your advisor, you're not going to succeed in the field. And that's why a lot of women end up leaving. And so that culture of silence, you know, it's going to affect my career. Other people are not going to believe me. It's a symptom of the larger cultural problem. And astronomy is a huge field. There are lots of different subfields, but my particular subfield is exoplanets. And so I had been warned about this guy, you know, years ago, and someone told me through this underground information, you know, don't be alone with this guy at a conference. If you ever see him, like, you know, try to stay away from him because he's dangerous. And so I never had to meet him, fortunately, I guess. But that was something that all the women knew, because they're handing out this information to each other to protect each other. Mm-hmm. But the men, you know, by definition, never hear about it. Yeah. So it's this, the whole system that allows these problems to happen. And then, you know, we have to come up with ways to protect each other. But it's not effective. It's not good enough, right? So.
Well, yeah, I mean, it gets, I mean, the whole thing is connected to this culture of victim blaming and you needing to protect yourself and keep yourself away from this guy who's still in a position of power, which is so messed up.
Yeah.
Well, I also, I want to jump off of that concept because we were talking in our Uber here, or Lyft, sorry.
It's Lyft.
Our Lyft here. about, I wonder if it's a generational thing because all you have the same sexism and the same harassment, but all of a sudden you have all of these women in the past year or so really starting to speak out and say, not only is this not okay, but we're going to hold you accountable. Versus the advice columnist who wrote for, I think it was Science Magazine,
yeah.
Who, yes, and somebody wrote in and said, you know, I'm being harassed, I'm, you know, my boobs are getting stared at the office, like I'm experiencing all this stuff, what do I do? And the advice columnist said, well...
And this was a woman writing.
Yes, it's not a dude. And the lady person said, you know, just deal with it.
You just have to put up with it.
It's part of the job. It's part of the industry. You know, you should just put up or shut up. And so, like, what's going on there? Is this a generational thing? Or what do you feel like is behind part of this shift?
So I think that social media plays a hugely important role because, and Twitter especially, Twitter is actually the social media platform that best represents the demographics of the U.S., right? So other social media platforms like Reddit, you have a bunch of, you know, men who are between the ages of, like, you know, 16 and 35 or whatever, and white men, and they dominate the conversation. Whereas on Twitter, you have, you know, more diversity, and so you get more voices heard. So traditionally, women did not have a platform to speak. Minorities did not have a platform to speak. And now social media is providing that. So it's not that these conversations weren't happening before. It's that no one was listening. Mm-hmm. And social media provides a platform for people to actually, you know, those voices get amplified. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about some of those campaigns, the ones that have stood out to you as extremely effective?
Yeah, so absolutely this Jeff Marcy case. I feel like most people have heard about that, even people who are not at all in touch with astronomy. So that was a really big one. After that story broke, AstroSH was the hashtag that people used. And it was, so it stands for sexual harassment. And people were talking about it. People were coming out with their own stories, supporting, you know, the victims and trying to get this guy fired. And our community put so much pressure, not just on the University of California, Berkeley, but also on the journalists who were writing headlines sympathizing with Jeff Marcy, who were writing content that, you know, they were quoting his wife for some reason as like a legitimate source of information. And
that was in the New York Times.
Yeah. And so our community did not stop. I mean, I'm part of this Facebook group that's, it's for equity and inclusion in physics and astronomy. And all the people in there were like, we're writing a letter. Like, who's going to sign it? Who's going to help us draft it? You know, or we're over here on Twitter, like, talking about this. Like, everybody, like, get on board. And so we really organized. And there were some key people doing that organization, too. And so AstroSH, I mean, it has had a huge reach, not just for that case, but more recently there was a case of a sexual harassment Title IX investigation that happened about Tim Slater. This happened like 10 years ago or something, but now he's at a different university. He was also found in violation. Now he's at a different university doing really well and getting paid and everything because that information was either not disclosed or dismissed. So he was found in violation. Then his next employer either knew the information and didn't do anything about it or just straight up didn't know. So recently, Representative Jackie Speier, she's a representative from California, she heard about this through this hashtag. I think it was actually her staffers who informed her about it. And she's now proposing legislation that's going to make these Title IX investigations, at least in the state of California, transparent so that information becomes public, right? The conclusions of the investigations become public. And that, you know, to force universities to share that information with a future employer of the perpetrators. And that would be huge. Because currently, it's, you know, you have a Title IX investigation and then nothing happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally a slap on the wrist, and sometimes not even that.
I mean, that's incredible, though. I mean, I feel like hashtag activism is dismissed a lot of times. It's like, oh, that's so cute, your little hashtag, fun. But, I mean, these things are creating actual political institutional changes. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I think the people who complain about it are usually the people who don't need it. So, like, you know, if you're a white dude and you see yourself represented everywhere, like, of course you don't see the purpose of it. But I actually, for people who normally don't have a voice, it's a huge deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like that divide is also, I mean, speaking of the New York Times, it's reflected in our mainstream regular media that you have. I mean, if you need to look at who's in your newsrooms and who is then covering issues like sexism in science, and then that colors how those stories come out. And then, of course, people who aren't in science, they are reading these mainstream media outlets, and that is informing their opinion of what's going on.
Exactly.
You do whatever it takes to make sure your business runs efficiently, but constant trips to the post office can get in the way. With Stamps.com, you'll be able to spend less time at the post office and more time growing your business.
That's because Stamps.com makes mailing and shipping easy. You use your own computer and printer to buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or any package. Stamps.com basically does all the thinking for you. And you can join over 500,000 small businesses that use Stamps.com and never go to the post office again.
And right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code STUFF to get a special offer. It's a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in STUFF. That's Stamps.com. Enter STUFF.
And now, back to the show.
Speaking of mainstream media, so there was a Wired article headlined 2015 was the year we really started caring about sexism and science. And there are a couple parts that really jumped out to me because this really is a new thing that even science journalists are talking about. You know, that's why we wanted to talk about science communication, because we've been hearing a lot of these issues within academia, but it's also an issue in the information that we're hearing about it and how it's being reported. And may I quote from the Wired article?
Please.
There it is. Okay, so they interviewed Deborah Bloom, who is a science journalist and also director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT. So this woman knows what she's talking about. And she said, quote, "I don't think we saw these kinds of news stories and saw this kind of reaction in the journalism community in earlier generations. We're all catching up to this kind of cultural awareness." And then later on, the Wired writer had to say, yeah, I mean, and also if we look at Wired, this is when I have to also own up to the fact that we have only sporadically covered this issue as well. And the writer said, "We've been silent on many of these stories because we've long hoped to cover the ways that science can make the world better, not reflect the world's problems. But that's wrong, of course, and ignoring social inequality doesn't fix it."
Yeah. Well, I mean, I also think there, I mean, I didn't read the article, but there's also the issue of when you have science represented by white men, right? Mm-hmm. Then the other people who participate in science are not as important because they're not as numerous. And so why would you report on things that don't affect your white male audiences or don't affect most scientists, right? Because they're mostly composed of white men. So I think there's that branch of it too. I think that affects it.
Well, and going to something that you talked about earlier in terms of people assuming, oh, well, science is so objective. You know, they're so smart. Like these kinds of issues are totally separate. And I think it's that idea of almost like church and state of like, oh, these like human-y feelings things like sexism are like over here and like separate from science because those are facts.
Right.
And that's logic. And they don't belong together. And that sentiment is also, I mean, almost reflected in this Wired article. So I'm kind of wondering what your response is when people say, like, talking about sexism has no place in science communication. We should be talking about science, right?
I love the story of how in the U.S. there was, you know, federally funded experiments and studies set out to prove that certain races were inferior to other races, namely the Caucasian race, right? So there were scientists who were taking skulls of different races of human beings, and they were filling the skulls with beans or peas or something so that they could measure the volume and say, okay, see, this one has a bigger volume of the skull, so therefore their brain is bigger, so therefore they're smarter, therefore they're better of a race, right? What they didn't say is that they're, and they literally believed that this was an objective experiment. And then you realize, well, they used smaller bodied skulls for the women and for the other races. And they preferentially selected skulls from larger bodied people to represent the Caucasian race. And then you want to tell me that science is objective and, you know, scientists don't bring their own biases into it. I mean, it's absolutely true. And that wasn't that long ago. And this is, again, federally funded experiments to do this. So it was like legitimate science. And I always point that out. Like, you can't just use science as, you know, you're the arbiter of truth when it's human beings who are conducting the science. Human right. beings who grow up with all these biases that we get in society.
So. Yeah, it goes back to gatekeeping. Not only who are the journalists covering the press releases and the new discoveries, but also who is doing the experiments. And so I think it's easy for a lot of people, white guys in science, to dismiss the
hashtag
notion.
Hashtag not all men.
Hashtag not
all
men.
White male scientists.
But it's easy for a lot of people to poo-poo the idea that we need more women or people of color or trans scientists because, you know, why? Why? It's just science. It's objective. But, you know, what do people approach you with these thoughts and ideas, and what do you tell them?
Yeah, how can diversity possibly make science any better? Facts are facts. All you need is a microscope, right?
So, right? I think an interesting idea is that diversity initiatives have been around since like the 70s, right? I mean, you looked around and they're like, there are only white dudes in science or in, you know, other areas as well. And the fact is, you know, when you look at it today, those initiatives have largely benefited white women because, you know, you have a bunch of white dudes and you tell them you have to diversify and they're like, okay, we'll take women. But that means just white women, right? So it's just sort of like, we just have to do the bare minimum here. We can't include women of color. We can't include, you know, trans people or gay people because it's just like, if we're going to include anyone, let's at least keep the race homogeneous or whatever. So I just think, you know, people who don't understand that, it's really hard to get them to see otherwise. But I like to bring that example up as, you know, an example of it's just not the way it works.
Yeah, I mean, there was even, I don't know when it was reported, but not long ago in the New York Times on how there is finally being attention paid to all of the mice and lab rats, which are usually like the human analogs, you know, so many studies are conducted on them, but they're almost exclusively male rats because of the assumption that female
hashtag
rats...
Hashtag not all rats.
Hashtag not all rats or mice, you know, under the assumption that those female rats and their lady brains...
Oh my God, those hysterical rat uteruses.
Yes, but legitimately that their hormones would throw off studies. And we've seen the same kind of thing in human studies, especially for biomedical research.
Oh yeah, I would just like to insert that the female Viagra, you guys read about how it was tested on men? I would like to just insert that as an example. Yeah. Continue, please.
Now I'm off. Female Viagra.
That's on Viagra? What?
But there's only in like the past couple years been attention to that. And I mean, things like, oh, pain medicine, huh? That impacts female bodies different than male bodies. Maybe we need to work on that. And that's incredible. I mean, we're talking about science, right? But we're still like catching up in really basic ways. But thanks to this kind of activism.
Yeah. So who are some of the people that we should be following on social media besides you? I mean, we already follow you. People we should be following on social media, but also maybe some great hashtags that are doing a really good job, particularly good job of raising awareness, and maybe just people that we should be aware of who are in this community having these conversations. That's like a multi-layer question, sorry.
No, well, I do want to talk about that because these are people who have heavily influenced me and taught me just everything in the last year or so. So the first person I want to mention is Dr. Shonda Prescott Weinstein. She's the 63rd Black woman to have a PhD in astrophysics in the history of the United States, okay? And which is just mind-blowing that there's that few Black women being awarded PhDs in astronomy. And she is just amazing. I mean, she's an activist. She talks about race and sexism in science. She talks about, you know, heterosexism, just all kinds of things. So she's amazing, and I just learned so much from her. And she has a blog, actually. And one of the things that she was one of the first people to say this when the Jeff Marcy story broke out. She pointed out that maybe the only reason that we care about these sexual harassment cases is that they affect white women. You mm-hmm. know, and she talked about how we have a Title IX office on every university campus in this country. Where's my Title IV office? You know, where is the office that's going to handle racism on these campuses? And some people might be like, well, you know, sexism leads to terrible things. It might lead to rape or murder. But actually, racism does as well. And we're not addressing those things. And we're seeing all the violence that comes out of racism now with a lot of social media and how people have been reporting police brutality and all those things. So I think it's just as important. And she's one of the people who's at the forefront of like, hey, we need to make this issue intersectional. Mm-hmm. And so she has a blog on Medium, and she talks about just all these things that you're going to learn so much. You should definitely follow her. Also, Sarah Tuttle, she's an astronomer here in Austin at UT. And so she's great. She also talks about sexism from an intersectional approach in science. Jessie Shanahan is a PhD. She's a grad student at Wesleyan, and she talks about all kinds of isms in science, but she's also a huge disability activist. Mm-hmm. So I learn a lot from her. As an able-bodied person, I feel like we just don't see the world the same way, and we're blind to a lot of things, and that's something that's super important. I also want to give a shout-out to Dr. Jedidah Eisler. She's another black woman with a PhD in astrophysics from Yale, first black woman from Yale to graduate with a PhD in astrophysics ever, which is also an atrocity and an accomplishment at the same time. And she has a monthly vlog. It's like a Google Hangout, and she brings in other women of color from science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and she interviews them, and they talk about great things. So it's been a great thing for me and for other women of color in science, but I think also just for other people, for visibility. If you want to learn about other women who are currently scientists and women of color, you should definitely watch this Google Hangout that she has. It's called Vanguard STEM, and she's also on Twitter as well.
Okay. So you had mentioned earlier when we were kind of talking about the generational shift and the silencing effect and the risk of kind of going forward with claims of sexual harassment or gender discrimination, racism, et cetera. And now we are seeing, you know, so much more conversation, especially through social media and Twitter about that. And I was wondering if there is still that risk of backlash, or if Twitter and technology and kind of the visibility and community building that they provide, if that's sort of provided an insulating effect to that.
So unfortunately, this is a field that is very slow to change. So I do think that that there is probably retaliation. Like, there's still fear of retaliation, of course. But the more people who come out and counter this culture of silence, the easier it is for other women behind them and other people behind them who experience all of these isms to come out and have a voice for themselves. Killer Mike was talking about earlier how he wants to be a voice for people who don't have a voice. And I feel the same way. I mean, the people, the women who came out in the Jeff Marcy investigation chose to have their names attached to that media piece. They chose to have their names attached to that Title IX investigation publicly. Mm-hmm. And they have gotten death threats, rape threats, and all kinds of, you know, horribleness. But they've also had, you know, a lot of support from our community. And so, you know, their brave actions are what, you know, empower other women to do this. And I think really the only way is to talk about it. But I don't fault women who don't come forward, because, you know, your career's on the line. It's easy for me to talk about this knowing that I'm leaving research and I don't, you know, none of these people have anything over me. And, you know, I'm going to get my PhD and then I'm going to go do something else. But when you're staying in that community and you need to do your research and you need to get recommendation letters and you need to have people supporting you, I can completely understand why they wouldn't come forward with those kinds of things. So hopefully this will, I mean, I know that we're progressing in the right direction. Hopefully, you know, faster rather than slower.
Yeah. I mean, and oh, the irony that science is so slow to change. And that kind of
exactly.
The opposite of how that should be. I mean, is there, what do you think it will take, though? I mean, obviously it will take more than hashtag activism and things like that. But what do you think it will take to make it not such a hostile environment for not just women, but people of color, disabled people, et cetera?
So right now, a lot of the young people are taking up these causes. I mean, even being outspoken on social media is a risky move. Mm-hmm. If you're a young person, you know, if you're a postdoc or like a grad student and people find out about it, you might not have a good career. So I think honestly, the onus is on the professors, people with power, people who have tenure. And really, I think the white men in this profession, if they want to see astronomy going forward, in being successful and having more discoveries and everything, then really the onus is on them to start these changes, to, you know, educate yourself about the issues and about who's getting left behind and, you know, trying to make a change. And I actually see that happening now because more people are talking about it and it's more visible. You know, departments are coming under fire. You know, University of California, Berkeley is definitely under fire. People are starting to pay attention to, like, save their own asses. And I think it's really going to take those people in the higher places because they're the ones with the power, right? And the younger people are going to continue to change things and push through. But as long as those people remain in power and want to do nothing about it, then that change is going to be so slow. Mm-hmm. It'll happen still eventually, but it'll just be too slow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what can we non-scientists do? You know, like, because it affects us. At some point, it trickles down to all of us.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's this image that that society has about what a scientist looks like. And that image gets passed around through media, and it gets passed down to younger children who then don't believe that they can be a scientist because they don't play the part, right? Mm-hmm. So I think talking about it and like sharing this information, supporting the people who are on the bad side of this, you know, the victims of the sexual harassment. If you talk about it on your own social media pages with these hashtags, it gets the information out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these scientists who are committing these crimes, really, because if it's sexual assault, it's a crime and they're, you know, that's another story. But these people are paid by your tax dollars. The money that comes that pays these professors comes largely from the big agencies like the National Science Foundation, NASA, the National Institutes of Health, the Department of Energy. This is all taxpayer money. And so we should all care about this and try to spread this information so that future generations don't have to live with this.
Absolutely. Woo.
is there anything else that you want our audience to know about you or your efforts?
Yeah, where
STEM?
Should we go?
Yeah, and also tell them, yeah, how to find you.
Okay, well, my Twitter handle is at Jazztronomy, so JAZZTRONOMY. I can actually spell it this time, it's great. So you can follow me, and I post a lot on Twitter and everything. I try to do as much as I can. So, I mean, I'm one person, but as much as I can, I like to try to support people like me because, mm-hmm. honestly, the motivation that I have is that I went through this really hard thing that not a lot of people, I mean, 90% of people in this country will never get a graduate degree, will never get a PhD, and that was really hard for me. So I knew what it was like, and I didn't want anybody else to go through that. So I turned around and I started a graduate mentoring program in my department, where like older grad students will mentor younger grad or incoming grad students. And right now we're seeing, ironically, a lot of problems come up, right? Mm. And, you know, people are going like, why are we having all these problems now? And I'm going, you know, these problems existed before, but they flew under the radar and, you know, people were suffering silently. But now that we have something in this department where students can actually talk to someone who will understand where they're coming from, that's why these problems are surfacing. And it's a good sign because it means that people are talking about it and now we can address those issues. So I don't know. I want to take that message. I want to reach out to communities of color, people who are not represented in science, and encourage them to go into STEM. Which is a double-edged sword because I'm like funneling them into a system where they might, you know, encounter a hostile environment. But I think empowering these people too and letting them know like, hey, science is just like the rest of the world. There's going to be sexism. There's going to be racism. There's going to be ableism, you know. and letting them know, like, here's how you empower yourself. Here's how you fight that. You know, don't let anybody tell you that you can't do it, because you can. And having, like, for me, getting a PhD, like, being an immigrant and a woman of color and getting that far, I can turn around and say, you know, I did it and you can do it as well.
And one last thing, since this is Stuff Mom Never Told You, even though the name might suggest otherwise, we do like to give mom shout outs. And one thing that you shouted out in your TED Talk was how your mom kind of accidentally raised you as a scientist. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, because I love that story so much.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. So, a lot of you may not know this, but like Latina culture is just, the mother is basically, she's like the boss of the house, and Latin women are just so empowered. And my mom raised me that way. She was, you know, really tough and everything, but she raised me to believe that I could really do anything. And you know, when I'll tell the story again, but when I was young, I would, even really like 3 or 4 years old, my mom would tell me like, go clean your room, or, you know, go tidy this up or something. And I wouldn't do literally anything until she would sit down and explain to me why I had to do it. And sometimes she would cry. Like, she's told me, like, I would cry because I'm sitting here, like, for an hour, you know, arguing with a 3-year-old about why she should clean her room. But the thing is, you know, she sat down and she did that. She knew that, like, I mean, she knew from experience that grounding me wasn't going to do anything. I was still not going to follow her orders or whatever. So she did what she knew worked for me. A lot of parents wouldn't have done that, you know. I know a lot of people who would not have done that. And I just think that her reinforcing that, like, my questions were important and they deserve to be validated. And, you know, I didn't have to take no for an answer. I didn't have to just be satisfied with any answer that people wanted to tell me, you know. Mm-hmm. That really, that's what science is. Science is, you know, having a question and just pursuing it and failing and trying again until you get the right answer. And so I think that really is one of the biggest reasons that I'm a scientist today.
Yes, I love that. Thank you. And thanks, Nicole's mom.
Yeah. Thanks, Mom.
Well, Nicole, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, we're really excited that you're doing what you're doing. We're so excited to see what you do in the future. And we're really glad you're in Atlanta because we're going to hang out.
I know. She's so fun, y'all. Please give it up for Nicole.
Thank you.
So there you have it, folks. Thanks so much to everyone who came to the show. Huge thanks to Nicole Cabrera, who I am convinced is going to change the world.
Yeah, Nicole is amazing. And we're, as we said in the show, we're super excited to see where she takes her science education career.
And we're hoping that we'll be able to take our live show to other places at some point. I know that we've talked about it and longingly posted on social about where we should go if we were to have a live show. So it is top of mind for us because, again, we love meeting you all, whether it's for lady drinks like we've been doing in some cities or live shows. So if you are a group and can bring us to your city, or if you run a venue and can bring us to your city, let us know. CNC, you're down to travel. So drop us a line at momstuff@howstuffworks.com. And of course, we also want to hear your thoughts on everything we talked about in that live show on sexism and science communication. So momstuff@howstuffworks.com again is our email address. You can also tweet us at momstuffpodcast or message us on Facebook. And we've got a couple of messages to share with you right now.
Well, I have a letter here from Cecilia in response to our adult coloring books episode, which we have received so many emails about. You guys really like your coloring, which I kind of love. Okay, so Cecilia says, as someone who does not partake in adult coloring now, I did not anticipate that I would relate so much to the episode, but I do, so here goes. My mom began teaching art in the early 70s and subsequently built her career on researching and teaching about the history and practices of art education. So of course my brother and I grew up on Susan Stryker's anti-coloring books. I remember feeling frustrated by the blank spaces, and I often simply colored in the illustrated vignettes and moved on to the next page. I cherished the single normal coloring book I owned, a Barbie fashions book, but I spent a lot of time drawing my own fashion models as well. Though I kind of loathed them, in retrospect, I think the anti-coloring books were a positive influence on my creative development. I believe that drawing versus coloring improves visual literacy and helps kids build confidence. Through my own experience teaching art, I find that most kids show more joy and higher self-esteem after creating self-directed works of art as opposed to completing a predetermined project. The traced hand turkey, for example. Aw, why we gotta hate on the traced hand turkey? I still draw those. Ah, she goes on to say. As for adults, I agree that coloring in between the lines is probably more of a sedative than a stimulant. In college, where I earned my BFA, my friends and I would de-stress at night by smoking weed and coloring in our dorm. While I imagine that I would still enjoy this activity today, I feel obligated to put any free creative energy into making art, a practice that always suffers because of my job and other responsibilities. Thanks again for the episode and for the welcome distraction your show brings to my hours working as an art framer. Well, thank you, Cecilia.
Well, I've got a letter here from Marilyn, who is all about some adult coloring books, which... Caroline, whenever I hear the phrase adult coloring books, it does sound like something naughty.
Oh, for sure. Oh, without a doubt.
But Marilyn writes, I just finished listening to your episode on adult coloring books, and I had to roll my eyes a little at the fuss over coloring books stunting creativity by being a, quote, mindless activity. As someone who does have other creative hobbies like crochet and fiction writing, I can definitely say that my coloring books, one of which I was working on while listening to the episode, aren't making a creatively stagnated robot out of me. Coloring may not be as demanding as other pursuits, but I'd argue that that's what's so great about it. It allows people to exercise a simple, low-stress creativity without the real or perceived pressure to make something perfect. Talking to people with creative pursuits like writing or art, one of the most common threads you'll find is the anxiety and dissatisfaction over imperfect finished products. Not that I'm speaking from experience or anything. With coloring, you get to exercise the same creative impulse, but without fear of the world crashing down around you if you color outside the lines or that shade of orange doesn't work as well as you thought it might. Coloring is certainly more engaging than a lot of the games I play on my tablet to kill time or procrastinate. And yet at the same time, it doesn't require me to have my brain at 100% at all times and offers a restful and harmless activity to keep my hands busy while I process the rest of my day. As always, great podcast, and I look forward to future episodes, some of which I will definitely listen to while coloring. So thanks so much, Marilyn, and thanks to everyone, all of you who've written about coloring, especially so many coloring letters and photos. We love to see your coloring photos. And for all of your other emails, momstuff@howstuffworks.com is our email address. And to keep up with all of our social media links, blog posts, videos, and podcasts with our sources so you can learn more about sexism and science communication, you should head on over to stuffmomnevertoldyou.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands. Not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank. Brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.